From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Michael Cobb has written a book that makes the case for those who choose to live a life alone, as a single person. He's not saying people shouldn't make meaningful connections in their lives, and he's not saying single people don't have an ethical responsibility toward others. What he is saying is that it's okay to want to live your life without a partner, though it's not easy to do, especially in a culture, he says, which sees the single life as a sad, antisocial, and temporary state. It's a mystifying, reviled condition marked by failure. And Cobb's theory about being single is interesting because in some way he says he's taking the burden of the whole world off the shoulders of the couple. Michael Cobb today. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the academic Michael Cobb, who is joining us to make a case for those people who choose to live their lives alone, not lonely, but single, people who decide to live without a partner for life. And Cobb says in America, the single life is seen as a sad, antisocial, and temporary state. In the book he's written, Cobb comes to the defense of single people, and he goes on the attack against what he calls the dominion of coupledom. Michael Cobb is joining us today, and we invite you to join the conversation as well. 801-585-WEST is our number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. The book is called Single, Arguments for the Uncoupled. Michael Cobb is a professor of English at the University of Toronto, and he is also the author of the book God Hates Fags, The Rhetorics of Religious Violence. Joining us today from a studio in Los Angeles, Michael Cobb, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. I'm glad to be back.
Well, I want to start with a story you tell right off the bat in the book, because I think it really kind of expresses some important themes for the book. And it's with a conversation you had with your grandma Jewel, your grandmother, and her kind of, I guess you could say, her deathbed request. Well, I guess it was more than a request.
It's a demand.
It was a demand to tell that story, if you would, to get started.
No, seriously. I mean, my grandmother, a lovely, lovely woman, and, you know, surrounded by family and friends, all sorts of people who adore her. And she pulls me aside and begs me to find a partner. She's very upset that I don't have a significant someone. And she says, you don't want to die alone. And it's a threat we often commonly hear when you say things like, I'm single and by myself. And there's this anxiety that you're going to die by yourself. So I understood why she said it. Mm-hmm. But it just sort of jump out at me is this is interesting. Why is she worried? Her husband, my grandfather, had died many years before, and she wasn't alone. So
yeah, yeah.
And a deep anxiety seemed to kind of be around my not coupling. So I decided to write a book about it.
You talk about how your grandmother had, as you said, this great marriage,
mm-hmm.
And had this deep faith. You say deep faith in romantic couple love. Mm-hmm. And you say everyone kind of uses this as the personal filter. Mm-hmm. Talk about the way we kind of define relationships, that kind of romanticism we have in couple love.
And again, it makes a lot of sense. A lot of people have wonderful couples. And actually, so this book is actually even against those people who have those wonderful couples. And again, we use these relationships that we build with people to make sense of our lives. They're the ones who are kind of grounding us. They're our mooring posts. They're our touchstones. And so for my grandmother, and actually for her grandchildren, we got to learn so many of the great historical events of the 20th century through the courtship stories of grandpa. You know, he was on a World War II. He was on a ship on the South Pacific making pancakes as a ship's cook, writing love letters to my grandmother. And so we start to learn about war through their relationship as a child. So I think we obviously personalize history, and what's more personal than your own specific significant other? And that makes a lot of sense because everyone out there is constantly encouraging you to have that one particular other. And so if you have that one other, you get tied to the world in a much more specific and important way, which is wonderful on one hand. But again, I think one of the things I tried to diagnose or try to figure out or at least kind of speculated about is I think that one filter is becoming dominant. That's the relationship you're supposed to have. It ceases ceases to be something you choose and suddenly becomes something you were required to have. So don't die alone.
Yeah.
You need to have a personalized account of the world, and that's through your relationship. And it starts to be coercive as opposed to something you've chosen to do.
It's interesting, too, the way you write about your grandmother's marriage, in that she felt that it worked for her, and you say that's kind of the official story, you know, all these great mm-hmm. moments. But then you say, but you don't know what the real story was. You talk about how you'd never really seen them kiss or hug, which doesn't mean they weren't happy, of course, but
exactly.
You do kind of raise a question about what was really the inside story about that relationship.
Well, exactly. And that's the thing. You never actually know the story of any relationship. And even in your own specific relationships, you don't fully know the whole story, because you're never going to actually know what that special someone is thinking. You have to rely on self-reporting. You have to rely on a repertoire of gestures, familiar behaviors to kind of glean what a partner is thinking about. But when it comes down to it, you don't really know everything about that other person. And so, of course, on the outset of a couple, how are you going to actually know what's going on? So my grandfather, this was his second marriage, and I was shocked to find that out when I was older. I was like, what? So there was, and there was no mention of that. So again, it's something that's supposed to, it's a highly romanticized version, her memory of a relationship. And I think we have lots of nostalgia and romanticizations of our relationships, which is on one hand wonderful, on the other hand, doesn't necessarily get to the stranger, weirder underbelly of significant romantic relating.
Mm. We should say that while you were writing this book, you were in a relationship. You're single now,
uh-huh.
but so this isn't just sort of a defense of your own preferences in life or the way you want to do it. And you've talked about how people sort of chided you when you were writing the book about what's your deal or what's your problem or something. Talk about that.
Yeah, no. I mean, what's so fascinating about this is, again, there's actually been a number of people who have, interviewers since the book has come out, say things like, you know, you must have had a really bitter breakup.
So, right.
But the majority, it's like, oh, thanks. the majority of the book was written while I was in a couple, partly because I had been single for many years before I was in that relationship. And in both conditions, both being single and both being in a couple, I was, you know, the same person. I was more or less equally miserable in both. I'm just. But I mean, in both situations, one was not necessarily better than the other. They were just different experiences. But everyone assumes it is a defense of singleness. You know, you're just bitterly waiting for that moment when you can actually change your status to finally being in a couple again. And I think that's what's so fascinating to me, is that people do not necessarily want to kind of validate a single experience that endures.
Yeah.
So it's partly because they actually don't want to have a language and a conversation about what singleness is. It's all about this temporary waiting condition to either become, you're either pre or post coupled. There's nothing in between. And that's vexing. I thought it was especially important, especially when I was coupled, to write about singleness, because, you know, it became me trying to figure out what it is to live alone and what it is to live with other people, and to realize that no one situation is the, you know, that silver bullet that's going to make your life complete and whole and happy.
You know, what's interesting, too, is that the book is almost as much an analysis of the couple as it is the single. And as you explain in the book, the kind of impossible burden on the couple. You say something intriguing in the book, that couple love is an ideological apprenticeship in loneliness.
Exactly.
Nice turn of phrase. Explain it, though.
I know. I love it when actually interviewers have read the book. That's very exciting and shockingly refreshing right now after this month of media.
Yeah.
But no, what's really fascinating is, I mean, it's the book had to actually be more about couples than singles, strangely enough, because we don't have a language, as I said. We don't have a history. We don't have a culture of really positive representations of what single life is like. Mm. And so I was wondering, why is that? What is all this cultural noise? This couple noise is all around. Like, don't you want someone to love? Please, don't you need someone to love? You better find someone to love, is the Jefferson Airplane song.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, do it now. There's just, it's such an insistence that the singleness is not good and that coupleness is the most important thing to do. I had to start investigating, well, what is that tension? What is that anxiety? Why do we have to insist on coupleness? It seems like it's protesting too much, you know? So, like, it is the best thing, really. And I think what what I discovered, and probably also discovered because I was in a relationship, is that sometimes you're the loneliest when you're sitting right next to someone or pressed up against someone else, when you actually can't know what's inside that other person's head, when you're anxious and nervous about, you know, whether or not that relationship will endure, even though it's supposed to be the thing once you've found love, it's going to complete you and make you whole and happy forever. It often doesn't. So, and that's a really alienating situation because you were told, you were sold a bill of goods since you were tiny, that's the key to happiness. Yeah. That's, you know, prince in shining armor. That's the end of the romantic comedy. What's next is, you know, they don't really tell you what's next. And then when you're in that what next, you know, the, you know, 40 hours after the 2 hours of the romantic comedy, the 40 years after the romantic comedy, it's hard work. It's sometimes disappointing. It's sometimes upsetting. So there's this really uncomfortable feeling that's in couple love that I think actually gets displaced onto single people, strangely enough. Like, oh, I'm miserable in my situation with this person right now, but it would be so much worse to be single. The singles have it much, much worse. And again, that's a way of misrecognizing and mischaracterizing the single condition, which is, I think, why my grandmother, why all sorts of friends when I was single couldn't appreciate that I would actually be happy, because no, that's worse. That's worse. And so the book started to investigate those feelings and those anxieties and those inducements to make the single kind of a scapegoat of the couple.
I mentioned this in the introduction, but it seems like you have to keep making this point that, as you say in the book, you're not talking about not making meaningful connections in life, and you're not talking about single people who don't have a responsibility to others and to be ethical. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because you say in some way you're taking the burden of the whole world off the shoulders of the couple.
Exactly.
Talk about that idea that you're not saying people shouldn't experience love, shouldn't experience relationships or connections. It's just that it doesn't have to be dependent on a partner. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, there's partly that. I mean, one of the things that, part of what I think happens with all this anxiety, with all this like sense of you better find that person to love, you better get involved with this person, otherwise you're not going to have a full and complete world, that puts an enormous amount of pressure on the couple. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that you're putting that person that you're in love with, they have to become your whole world. You know, and again, by definition, a person can't be a whole world. You know, they just can't. They're going to fail to be that. And so I think that a lot of expectation, a lot of anxiety, a lot of hope, a lot of desire is put on that one person. And I think that's one of the reasons that relationships often fail, is that, wait a second, this isn't everything. This has not completed me. This has not made me the happiest person on earth. And so it's a lot of a pressure that I think could be alleviated if we start to value, as opposed to pathologize, singleness. Mm. Because if you start to make singleness, I'd say, a more appetizing, less terrorizing condition, you could then start weighing your options. Like, okay, well, this person's not completing me over here, but maybe being by myself could be good for a while. Mm. And maybe I would leave that relationship and where we're no longer happy and we're no longer making each other happy and whole and healthy and we're not flourishing with each other, and be by ourselves and then maybe make another set of connections, or yeah, focus on our careers or focus on our friendships. And so I think what I'm getting at, and this is the problem, it's not necessarily specific couples. It's just the cultural, political, ideological imperative that this is the most important relationship you're going to have, and it's the most important route into social legitimacy and maturity. And everything else be damned. So,
you know, as you explain in the book, you're foremost a literary scholar, so a lot of this, yeah, is about language and a lot about rhetoric, and which we'll mm-hmm. break down and get to, of course. And this isn't something you really deal with in the book, but I did want to ask you a question that seems may come up from time to time. That's the sort of the question of nature, which is, mm-hmm. you know, did we evolve as creatures, as humans, you know, to be couples, to reproduce mm-hmm. and copy our genes? And how does that sort of come into play in terms of the argument you're making?
Well, nature arguments are always hard because yeah. we're always learning about nature through language, through history, through
right.
culture.
Right.
And so it's one of those things that, yeah, certainly I think we have the drive to not be by ourselves, that there's a protectionist feeling that we have, that we want to survive, and it's often easier to survive when you have other support systems around you. I know as a single person, it's a lot easier to have someone to help you with the dishes and mm-hmm. the yard work and all those kinds of chores. So it makes sense why you would want to find people. I don't necessarily know why it makes sense to like only find one person as opposed to a cadre of people, so or a village, as it were. So or you know, the typical parlance now is like an urban tribe, you know, or a collective people. You know, so there's all sorts of ways you can live like intimate, interesting bonds, and all sorts of experiments. But it's interesting to me that there's that those are kind of invalidated for this one special other person that then you nervously and anxiously patrol to make sure that they will always be there forever, which they of course can't be because people die. So it's a very interesting kind of thing that is happening. So it's whether or not it's natural or not natural, I can't necessarily know. But what I can see and kind of diagnose through the rhetoric, through the language, through the kind of the tax breaks, through friends who are so anxious about my marital or single status, and whether or not I will be that fifth person in the couple's dinner, staring at the person, no one across the across the table from you. Like it's that there's this push towards a certain kind of conformity that makes me anxious, that overvalues coupledom, that I actually think ends up hurting everyone, especially those in the couple.
Say something, because it kind of gets to the point of, let's go right to the movies, Love Story, which you write about. The book, of course, it's a book and a film. And you talk about how the story, this is how you describe it, kind of, I guess this is what you were getting at. It, as you say, shrinks the possibilities of the world in that it delivers this realization that the couple is always and only a temporary thing.
Yeah. No, it's – well, if you think about it, I mean, any kind of relationship can be temporary, partly because we are temporary creatures.
Yeah.
Certainly, we do have certain religious beliefs. Some people have religious beliefs that I don't necessarily prescribe to, but I understand what is going on. But they have a conception, especially, you know, in Utah of eternity, you know.
Yeah. I want to get to that. I want to spend more time with that. So let's get to that in a minute. So because it's great.
Yeah, so but basically, we do have the sense that, like, it's supposed – again, a number of years ago, they started changing the emphasis on wedding vows ceased to be until death do us part, and it started to become we're going to live forever in our love. Our love was eternal. Yeah. The rings of a wedding ring have no beginning and end, and so there's this sense that it's going to be there forever, and it just isn't, because we are temporary, strange creatures that will die, or your spouse can die, or he or she can leave, you know, or he or she can find someone else. And so there's this very strange kind of vexing situation that happens, which is this thing that's supposed to be solid and so secure is actually very fragile, very temporal loaded. And I think this is this kind of, it's almost a schizophrenic relation that you're sometimes relating to, is that this person I'm going to love forever, actually most, over half marriages end in divorce, as we famously know. We've had lots of breakups before, or, you know, most relationships have not worked. So you have all this like noise in your head that says, no, this like narrative of forever is not necessarily true. So I think that just makes people kind of just nervous wrecks, because you're in this paradoxical, strange situation. So so Love Story is this fantastic movie. I mean, it's terrible to watch, but actually kind of quite fun to watch, which really emphasizes this like strange like fragility and endurance at the same time. And the whole story is more or less framed by Ali McGraw's character. She's the woman, Radcliffe undergrad meets a Harvard grad, and they fall inexplicably in love. And they have a very short romance, because she gets ill and dies of what we think is cancer. And so the whole narrative's framed about that. This is a sad, small, temperate, finite time with this one person. You better do it. You better give it your all. It's important. I think, again, this gets not, there's a certain kind of ghostly haunting that happens in the Love Story, which is not unlike my grandmother saying, don't die alone. We're spooked into being in a couple, and we're worried about what it all means.
Michael Cobb is with us. His book is Single, Arguments for the Uncoupled. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the academic Michael Cobb. We're talking about his new book, Single, Arguments for the Uncoupled. You can join us 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go to the phones. Thad is with us, calling from Salt Lake. Thad, welcome.
Thank you. One of the questions I had was about the evolution of singleness over the course of one's lifespan. So it's one thing for, you know, somebody in their 20s or 30s to be single and to be able to network with people and to compensate for that, not having a couple. But it seems very different for somebody who's much older. And so, for example, there was a book that came out a couple of years ago called Heat Wave, and it was one of the findings of that book was that people in Chicago who were single, who were elderly, they tended to live alone. They tended to be much more kind of entrapped in their lives, and they were more likely to die of a heat-related illness because there was nobody to check in on them. They didn't have a spouse or somebody who was like their companion who could help them. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how this idea of singleness arcs over a lifetime.
You do write about, Michael Cobb, the studies that talk about being single as a case of social isolation and, you know, and its impact on health. Talk about that.
Well, yeah, and the excellent question, too, because the singleness is not an easy condition, and it definitely changes over time. And I definitely think the elderly in particular are really, really vulnerable. This is what my grandmother was getting at on her deathbed, which was, you know, don't die alone. Again, what I'm saying is that there's no guarantee that even if you get involved with that person, they're going to actually be around at the end of your life to help you from the Chicago heat wave. And that was actually the summer I moved to Chicago years ago. And so it was very, you know, and you got these reports, and they were grisly and sad. A more humorous take on this is on 30 Rock, Liz Lemon, before she got involved in the last season or so with someone in a steady way, would always be there would stage these like really high like physical comedy moments where she's always choking on food by herself and has to self-administer the Heimlich maneuver.
Yeah.
And so again, I'm not advocating that singleness is an easy position whatsoever. Like, it's hard, partly because we get this constant assurance that, okay, well, you would be able to be okay if you had that special someone there. But that special someone might become an invalid. So yeah. I think what's the thing is that we're kind of the argument to be involved with someone is often this argument to about the future terror that you will inevitably experience by yourself. And so you can alleviate that terror if you get involved with someone now. And so that's what I get anxious about, even though I do think that people who are older, who have less opportunities to go out, to meet other people, to have a social network, have it easy. They actually have it quite hard. Nevertheless, I think it would be nice. And I often wonder. I think if people put so much time and effort during their lifetime with just one person, as opposed to a large network of people, that maybe that's one of the reasons they're in that predicament at the end of life. Mm-hmm. You know, they've spent put all their eggs in one basket. That basket is gone. You know, maybe you've had lots of friends watching out for you, like Mike. You know, grandmother actually ended up having that, but that was because she had about 10 years without my grandpa, where other relationships were as vital to cultivate and to care about.
Thad, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. So what is it exactly that bothers those of us in couples about the fact that someone chooses to, you know what I mean? Because you define it as a social threat. And what is it exactly that's so threatening, do you think?
This is this is the thing. I think it is there to kind of, you know, it could, one narrative could be, or one explanation could be, oh, that person over there, they get to have so much free time. You know, my life is overscheduled.
Yeah.
Like, they get to walk around and they don't have that surveillance device called the cell phone that's like wondering where they are at every moment. So you have a lot of freedom or perceived freedom. And so there could be like kind of an annoyance, like, oh, well, I remember the good old days when I could, you know, self-determine and self-schedule and be happy. Again, I don't think that's actually what's going on here. I think that there's a sense that I think people are anxious about the choices that they make. And so, and if you've made that grand choice of that special someone and you're investing everything in that person, and it makes sense often why we do that, because we have all these like intense emotions when you get involved with people. And of course, the whole world seems to be kind of filtered through that person and you fixate. Mm-hmm. But once you've kind of gotten through that, you know, that exuberance, you know, that 6 months, 2 years, whatever, then you have to kind of like figure out what's going on. And you see this person over here. And And it could be a genuine concern for that person's well-being, but it could also just be, wait a second here, what else could I have done? How else could I have imagined my life? But you're not really allowed to have that, because if start imagining your life otherwise, you might actually make your life into something new. You might actually give up that couple. And I think there's a lot of cultural, political, economic pressure to stay with a special someone, and that special someone that you've made that commitment to. Mm.
You know, in the book, you write about these images that we have in popular culture, that and the way the sort of negative impression, of course, of people who choose to be single. But I was interested in whether or not, and I've heard you talk about that, of course, but I was also interested in, are there any images, or were there any images maybe in our past that were, you know, positive? I think about the loner, you know, the strong person who is alone. And you write about Thoreau, of course. And so was there a time when these people weren't seen so as, you know, pathetic and
well, this is what's so interesting.
Sad.
Again, it's all speculative, too. I mean, to try to figure out what happened when we stopped getting into heroes and got into relationships. You know? So in lots of ways, that seems to be the case.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, in the U.S., there's not been in contemporary U.S. politics. Could you imagine Romney or Obama not having a spouse?
Right.
You know, so you kind of have to be a legitimate citizen. And to be a legitimate citizen now means you have to have a spouse, you know, which is not entirely, you know, that's obviously not a requirement. You know, you're not going to be stripped of your citizenship, but you are culturally suspicious. You are strange and you're uncharacterizable. And so something has shifted where our focus is on what is making that person a strong and viable person. It must be the relationship, not necessarily their, you know, individual kind of abilities to succeed and influence and be charismatic. I do think, I mean, there's actually a couple of exceptions to this, like often on the Supreme Court, you know, Supreme Court justices that don't have spouses.
Yeah.
But they don't have to run for popular election. And so it's that kind of how do you make yourself seem not strange? Okay, have a spouse. And especially a spouse that's not going to speak up too much and try to change things like healthcare, like in the 90s. So what happens is, I don't know exactly, but it seems to be connected to a rise of industrial economics, where we actually started to have a spouse to be a choice and a choice that we have to anxiously make. Marriages are not arranged like they once were. They aren't necessarily as much about property, although they sometimes can be. So I think once we became more free to make strange choices, I think there was a lot of, like, you know, not so subtle pressure to make this choice, you know, get that married, become recognizable as that kind of consumer, that kind of citizen, become standard, become normal, and become predictable, because, you know, the world needs to have predictable voters, they need to have predictable consumers, they need to have predictable citizens, otherwise you can't govern.
An email from Tristan, who she's wanting to know whether or not single people are, you know, legally being discriminated against, and she wants to know, you know, talk about the benefits that are offered to couples that aren't to singles.
Oh, well, this is
taxes
huge.
And I mean, those kinds of things.
I know, it's just even it doesn't even. I mean, I do think there is a not so subtle form of, you know, cultural economic discrimination. We can even go that far. That's one of the reasons I ended up attaching the word, like the letter S for single, to the list of sexual minorities: lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, queer. S, because this is a despised sexual minority position, because you really are targeted as being inappropriate. So it's much more expensive to be single. You don't get the tax incentives. You don't get the tax breaks. You go to the store, you can't necessarily buy individual portions. I mean, I use this quick little moment, but it's really visceral and true. I often have unused product portions in my fridge rotting. So, like, the fridge will open up and it will be like the smell of my singleness. And so, you know, and so it's disheartening, because the world is really not built for you. And so you have to kind of, like, and you have to stake out. And the fact that this academic book has stirred up such an emotional conversation and such a media storm means that people are just dying to have this conversation, because, you know, you seem to be a strange freak or a fool for wanting to be single, for wanting to take on these tax burdens, for wanting to have your, say, your, uh, uh, you know, a if you have property and you are single and you die, it immediately goes to your family in a very peculiar way. So you don't necessarily have this easy way of articulating, okay, this is the kind of life I want to lead. These are the kinds of people who are important to me, and this is where I want my money, my property, my enthusiasm and happiness to go. Because again, we really are set on this one script of, couple, marriage, and whatever follows that.
Yeah. Here's an email from Karen. She says, in my experience, of myself and others, except for the elderly, she says, singleness doesn't last long. The tendency after a breakup seems to be go right on to a pair or bond with another special someone, be they good friends or a new romantic partner. And I guess the question she says here is, isn't there a human need for intimacy? And are you advocating many serial pair-ups?
I mean, one could, and there's a book called Against Love by Laura Kipnis who actually argues just that. Okay, just get over the tyranny of the couple form by just having lots of couples. Keep going from one thing to the next. And that makes sense. We do have, and again, I don't think singleness is actually against intimacy. I have lots of intimate and important connections with all sorts of people, pets, ideas, even coworkers, not necessarily the kind of intimacy that we're thinking about with pillow talk, but you get to know people in all sorts of ways. So I'm not against that. I'm just...
And you don't agree with Kipnis entirely, you say. I mean, because you say in the book, you say you want to think beyond sex and sexuality. In fact, here's what you write. Exactly. You say, I want to question what it meant to be in any kind of close intimate contact.
Mm-hmm. No, and this is the thing that's interesting about singleness. If we don't take enough time, again, I think it is that sense of, okay, you break up, find someone new. The way you get over a heartbreak is to find a new possibility where your heart will mend and go on. So, so what happens is that you don't have that time and space away from intimacy hunting, we could call it, to kind of feel alienated a little bit, to have a particular kind of distance, to start making these big questions. Like, why do I want this? Why don't I want something else? And so I think what I've just kind of settled on for what singleness can provide is it can provide you kind of an interruption in these inevitable narratives of getting up involved with someone and therefore being completed, which you never really are.
Right.
And so so I wanted to kind of spend some time and deal with, this is not the happy solution to our vexing love game. So is to just be by yourself. But what it can do is it can give you a perspective that you might not necessarily have when you're in it. When you're with that person, when you're completely consumed by their gestures, their ideas, their droning thoughts about their careers, you're bored, senseless. I mean, so you are suddenly by yourself for a little while and it's terrifying, but then you can start regrouping, as it were, by yourself.
Here's an email from Nancy, who writes from West Jordan, Utah. She writes, I'm 59, been single for 13 years now. I found it difficult to meet men my age, and if I find someone, it's a lot of work and effort that I'm not willing to do. And she writes, I guess that's contentment.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. And again, but then you're made to be suspicious of that. I mean, the fact that I guess, as opposed to it's contentment, it could be, this is the thing. We don't allow people to feel comfortable that, well, maybe I just don't want to put that kind of work right now at this stage of life in this kind of search, because the people I'm finding aren't great. And if you think about the whole history of your own specific romantic lives, if you had them, is that there aren't that many great people out there that really go and match what you want, that attend to your needs, that kind of jibe with you. And so when it comes down to it, there just might not be a lot of people out there. So if you can get over searching for that kind of impossible person and just enjoy yourself or be okay after you get through that imperative to couple off, then I mean the world can unfold in another happy way. And so happiness does not have to be falling in love. It can be a whole range of other kinds of experiences.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Back to the phones. Shane is with us in Provo. Shane, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Hey, the comment I had is that it's kind of a strange paradox, because after you've been out of a relationship, the first thing that people tell you is you're not ready for a relationship yet. So there's this kind of taboo timeline that everybody has to wait for before... Yeah. You can jump into a new relationship. But for me, the reality has been that, me personally, I have to be in a relationship to be more grounded and to not be self-consumed and selfish. I mean, marriage for me has been something that helped me come out of my shell and actually be more, you know, be more giving and more productive because of it.
Mm-hmm. But what you're saying, that Michael Cobb, what you're saying is that's cool. That's fine. There are a lot of people who need that. I mean, and you're not arguing against that, I guess.
No, and that's exactly right. I think, I mean, again, the beginning of the comments from the caller was there's these narrative scripts that we have, like, okay, you're supposed to wait this long after you've been in a relationship before you can get something else, you know, or the person's supposed to be this age. You know, there's actually even someone was saying when they were talking about an age discrepancy in a relationship, there's some kind of calculus where, you know, you like half your age to minus six. I can't remember what it is, but like what's the acceptable age, like range before so where the relationship will work or not work. It's us all kind of relying on certain traditional conventional wisdoms, which if you think about falling in love, it's not wise. It's not conventional. It's often quite strange. And so who knows why things happen? I guess what I'm trying to interrupt is the sense that, okay, this which works for someone, like, okay, marriage for the caller allows that person, allows him to kind of pull himself out of his shell, to not be self-consumed, to be giving, to be ethical. That's great. That's wonderful. The problem becomes when that personal story becomes the overarching social requirement. And so that's when it ceases, individual choice ceases to be an individual choice and becomes law, you know, and law of the land. And so that's my anxiety. I'm actually not against couples in this book. I'm against the supremacy of couples and their controlling force and the expectation that we then bring to that couple that it's going to make everything great. Because anyone who's been in a couple knows that's not the case.
Shane, glad you called. Thanks very much. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Michael Cobb is with us. His book is called Single, Arguments for the Uncoupled. And we need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Michael Cobb. We're talking about his book, Single, Arguments for the Uncoupled. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Here's an email from Jen who writes that Michael Cobb uses the word happy repetitively, implying that happiness, fun, and entertainment are of higher worth over the course of a lifetime than building something like a family or a relationship built on memories and struggling through challenges. Often the things most worthwhile are things that were difficult and challenging and that we wouldn't have chosen or stuck with if there weren't something more than immediate happiness at stake. Respond to that if you would.
Well, again, I mean, I do. I often use the word happy kind of rhetorically to kind of get us out of the sourness of singleness, so and the loneliness and the sad, depressing affects. But I agree with that that email a great deal. You know, struggle, transformative experiences, hard earned love and intimacy and work is actually the thing I value the most. So it's really, singleness is not, and again, anyone who's really been single for a long time knows that it's not about instant gratification. It's actually quite the opposite. You know, so I think, but what I'm trying to think about when I get into arguing for singleness as something that's not just destitute is that you kind of have to like make it a little bit lighter of a category as opposed to the dark, dark abyss. Mm-hmm. But I think any relationship, whether you're single or not, any kind of relationship to your own work, to family members, to friends, you know, to colleagues, to pets, requires a lot of, you know, struggle. And that's what's kind of interesting. That's what's fascinating. That's when you learn. That's when you grow. That's when you make solid connections. Again, I get nervous that we then always think of the romantic relationship, the coupled, and the coupled relationship that then also can lead to a whole bunch of children as the place where real living and real work gets done. Because I think we're always doing it all the time, regardless of whether or not we've been lucky in love or have settled on someone.
Well, that reference to whole bunches of children may lead us to the section you write. I'm surprised how much Utah figured into this book.
It was back in 2007 when I started coming to Utah and did this program with my last book.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with Utah, and then I found ways to use research funds to get to southern Utah because I'm addicted to Capitol Reef National Park.
Yeah.
I mean, all the southern parks, I think it's just the most amazing place. If I could move to Utah, I probably would. So,
but you were talking about this idea of eternity, though,
yeah.
and this is absolutely, I mean, when you were talking about it earlier, how, you know, now this idea of death do us part, that seems to be sort of on the way out. In Utah, mm-hmm. you know, we absolutely, you know, whether you're a member of the Mormon faith or not, you get this idea of eternity.
Oh, of course. It's huge, you know, for time and all eternity.
Yeah.
Doctrines and Covenants 132. And so in the LDS faith, and it's the sense that what you're doing with this marriage is that you're not setting yourself up just for this life, but for forever.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and the way to get to forever and to get to kind of a happy forever where all of your family will be attached, sealed for time and eternity is through the right kinds of marriage practices and the right kinds of familial practices, which
yeah.
include having lots of children.
Yeah.
And so it's fascinating to kind of like see that. So what I ended up doing with my Utah examples, one chapter is on hiking and one chapter is actually on 19th century probate law that had to think about polygamy seriously
yeah.
in the history of the Mormon church. And what you're getting is the sense that with this eternity worldview is that the marriage is for forever. And I think that this is something that's not just specific to Utah. People now really feel like that these connections, even if there's all evidence to the contrary, are going to last forever. But again, it's that strong feeling that's supposed to be in the couple, and yet you're posed constantly with the fragility.
Mm-hmm.
And even get that with, you know, even with the Mormon worldview, you can fall out of favor. You can not practice the word of wisdom. You might not be able to go to the temple to get married. There's a whole series of situations. You might be gay. I mean, there's a whole bunch of situations where you will just fall from grace, be cast into outer darkness. And so it's this strange, strong and weak thing at the same time that I think it's that paradox that just drives couples a little bit crazy. So we kind of have to sort through that. And I think this is that kind of crazy feeling gets projected onto singles, thereby not allowing singles to kind of argue that we're actually not feeling those kinds of same emotions. We're not feeling that we're supposed to be strong and yet fragile at the same time.
Let's go back to the phones. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. And Ash is with us in Salt Lake. Ash, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I don't suppose my ideas are conform very well with the Utah ideas, but I just wanted to make the point that because you choose to be single, that now can be the right decision for you, but that doesn't mean that later on, at some point different in your life, you might not want to choose to be married, and that it can be better then. Mm. And that, you know, relationships are anything the people involved want to make it. Today, relationships you can design together to work for you. They don't have to conform to some traditional or antiquated stereotype or template. But I'm just saying, we can always choose again.
No, certainly. I mean, in the last 6 or 7 months, I've had these like two like back to back awful heartbreaks. But I've tried it, you know. So again, I'm not. I keep doing this. Like you're able to choose at different points what you may or may not want. I reveal to people when I've been interviewed, like that I am single, but I haven't been single at certain points, or sometimes I'm looking to not be single. They have this like, aha, gotcha, you know, like, you too are wanting to come over to the like marriage couple fold, ha ha ha. No, but really, what I'm kind of arguing for is something much kind of like, almost much more figurative, that we allow ourselves time and space away from the inevitability of the couple, even if we're in one. I mean, I actually think that singleness can sometimes be a condition that you could at least entertain even if you were in a relationship. And I know that's kind of a strange thought, but think about this. Like, I mean, part of the anxiety of the couple is to always kind of patrol and worry about that other person's existence, where they are at that particular moment. So, I mean, if you were to say to your spouse, go to your spouse, and I think very few marriages would be able to handle this, or very few couples, oh, I know we go on vacation together every single year, but how about this year we take separate vacations? You know, let's go be by ourselves for a while. Let's go be single for a while, see what else is important to us. And immediately people get, no, that's if they do that, they are unsatisfied. I'm not making their whole world possible for them. They are searching for something else. And I think it's that kind of tension and anxiety that I worry about, because I think that just puts too much pressure on almost every single gesture. So what I'm hoping for is that we're getting to that point where we can choose different things at different points. And the way, and I think the way that I articulate it in the book is that, okay, singleness allows you to have to start surveying the landscape in a different way. And that your whole world isn't that one other person who's standing in front of you, making vows to you of some sort. And once that happens, you could have your spouse now, you could get a spouse later, you could decide you want a whole group of friends, or you could decide that you want to be in a, you know, a adobe hut in New Mexico by yourself, painting pictures.
You know, you work through this really intriguing question in the book, what it is that a single person can give to the world. You know, what can a single person say to a world that doesn't want anyone ever to be single? And you work through these two figures, from one from a Ralph Ellison novel, The Invisible Man, and then another from a Herman Melville short story, Bartleby. Talk about that, if you would, this idea of that question of what can a single person give the world, or say to the world?
Well, I kept coming up against partly what happened was because there is no, you know, people, singles can't be talked about except negatively, like, oh, poor thing, you know, oh, poor thing. We actually don't know a lot about single people. You know, there's even if we know single people, that somehow they don't have that that language. They don't have that positive representation. They don't have an abundance of scripts to call from, to gather. So I kind of got up against a wall, as it were, like trying to figure out, well, how do I write a book about singleness when we really don't know what singleness is? And then I kind of flipped things and realized that's actually its virtue, that we don't know what's going on in single life. Because this is one of my really deep concerns, is that part of what couples culture does, part of what our intimate life does, is it's really about constantly being saturated in details. Where are you? Where have you been? Who have you been with? Like, you know, where are you going now? Let's put it on Facebook. Let's tweet about it. Now have like an Instagram photo. There's like this kind of intense saturation of all your specific details that we're really driven to know everything, gossip about everything. And so it's all part of this kind of driving people into a frenzy to act and be a certain specific recognizable way. With singles, you can't recognize them. They're weird. They're strange. They're bizarre. They're kind of bewildering. And I liked the fact that they're bewildering because it gives us that break, that interruption, that distance that I'm kind of arguing for, that, you know, moments out of the busy day of being a spouse. Like, what is that person thinking? I don't know. And so it's kind of blocking. What the single can say is nothing. You know, and they're not going to tweet about it, and they're not necessarily going to post it on Facebook. And that can infuriate people, but maybe it can snap them out of that sense of, I need to know everything now because I need to click it into a pattern. I need to make sense of it, and I need to hold on to it for dear life, because it might disappear even though I'm supposed to be with it forever.
There's a story you tell that you referenced earlier, having this affection now for the national parks in southern Utah. You talk about this hike that you took in Capitol Reef National Park. You describe it as the closest you've ever been to being truly alone. And you write about, I wanted you to kind of talk about this, because you write about wanting to hike just for the sake of hiking, you know, not with the purpose of getting to a place and seeing this really amazing vista, but with a purpose of just being present, I guess, or being aware of what's around you at the moment, I guess. Is that right?
No, it's exactly right. I mean, part of the thing that happened, you know, a lifetime of hiking around, you know, it was always to hike to, like, you know, a land bridge, hike to this arch, hike to, you know, this precipice, and then you hike back. Like, there's a sense that you have to have a goal. And that makes sense. And so part of what I wanted to do in this hike. I was by myself. It was the middle of August. It was 102 degrees. I was freaked out about how much water I had because I was doing this, like this hike. And it was a hike that had two hikes. And so I had to go to two different, because I wanted to subvert that like end shot, the money shot. Like that one's, okay, I'm going to go to that arch, but then I'm going to go to something else. So I was trying to like allow myself to just kind of enjoy the overarching experience, you know, and what I ended up getting was the sense that even though I was kind of trying to hike for my own self and kind of be, you know, outside of a specific destination, I still got to these huge vistas that still were astonishing to me. They were so exciting. They were thrilling. And to be by yourself and to not have to sit there and check your experience with someone else, like, oh, what, are you enjoying this view? Isn't this view magnificent? Mm-hmm. But just to be by yourself, to recognize how magnificent and large it was, it's a thrilling feeling because suddenly the world, instead of being small and shrunk, is large. And this is what I liked about it, is that suddenly I felt expansive as opposed to tightly controlled and contained. Mm. And it was a great way to get, to kind of get over what had then become a really bad relationship. And I did this hike not that long after I, was realizing that a relationship was bad and I had to kind of get out of it. I go on a hike and suddenly I realized the world is full of all possible connections. So something about that hike allowed me to kind of have that sensation, that feeling.
Mm. About a minute left. Let me ask you this. You say there's a question that, as you put it, haunts all of the book's pages. And it's, mm-hmm. Is this cheating of the self really necessary? Say mm-hmm. something about that finally, if you would.
No, it's not. I mean, when you're kind of out there looking at a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful landscape and seeing all sorts of lines and figures and clouds, you realize you are a large and interesting and magnificent self. And it isn't predicated on that person right in front of you telling you that you are. And so I think that this is part of what I'm trying to do, is to not cheat ourselves, into bad relationships, and to not cheat ourselves by thinking that singleness is the worst thing on earth, mm-hmm. because it's actually quite wonderful.
Are things changing? Are you seeing any transformation away from...
Well, it's exciting to watch to hear all these conversations percolating right now, like with this book, with my friend Kate Bullock's book, or essay she had in the article she had in the Atlantic Monthly. Like, people are craving the conversation. So we're basically starting to generate some interesting language. And I think that's fantastic. So something might be changing, but maybe not fast enough. Hopefully faster.
Michael Cobb. He's a professor of English at the University of Toronto. His new book is called Single, Arguments for the Uncoupled. He joined us today from the Garden of Sound studio in Los Angeles. And Michael Cobb, thanks very much.
Thanks. Always a pleasure, Doug.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Tim Slover is our intern. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Radio West, produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.